Some of you may remember when my friend Tim Flannery was on the program quite a long time ago, making the point that we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the depths of the ocean. The fact that much of our planet is covered by oceans and that they're very, very deep indeed means that we live on a planet in company with a vast mystery. We've poured a great deal of time and money into space exploration over the last half century, and yet we haven't seemed as inquisitive when it comes to exploring our own planet. As I said at the beginning of the program, fewer people have been to the deepest part of the ocean than have been to the moon. My next guest, Alex Rogers, is a veritable Captain Nemo who spent the past 30 years diving 20,000 leagues under the sea, pioneering expeditions under Antarctica and the Bermuda Triangle, discovering over 100 marine species in the process. Alex is also science director at the Norwegian REV Ocean Foundation and visiting professor of the Department of Zoology at Oxford, and he's just written a beaut book called The Deep, The Hidden Wonders of Our Oceans and How We Can Protect Them. And Alex joins us now from the BBC's Oxford studio. Alex, welcome to our little wireless program, and I promise to only ask you very shallow questions.
Thanks very much.
As I was saying when introducing you, fewer people have been to the deepest part of the ocean than have been to the moon. Why?
Well, it's extremely difficult. The deepest part of the ocean is nearly 11 kilometres or 11,000 metres deep. So you could effectively submerge Everest in that particular spot, the Challenger Deep and the Marianas Trench in the Western Pacific. And of course, it's cold, it's dark, and the pressure goes up by one atmosphere for every 10 metres you go down. So you need very, very expensive and specialised equipment to get down there.
It's fair to say, and once again I was making this point at the beginning of the programme, that making devices that get to those enormous depths is every bit as technically challenging as making a spaceship.
Absolutely. And I mean, the deepest I've been is about 2 miles down in the Indian Ocean. And to do that, you're put into a capsule made of titanium. It's only about 2 to 3 meters across inside. And there's a pilot, an engineer, and me, the scientist. So it's very cramped. And actually, much of the equipment kind of resembles the sorts of things you might expect to have seen on a rocket to the moon in the late 60s or early 70s.
Alex, I learned from your book that there's a special word for people like yourself who go below 200 metres. You're called bathonauts. Now, I understand that comes from the Yuri Gagarin of the deep sea, an American naturalist called William Beebe.
Yes, absolutely. William really did the first deep submergence investigations off Bermuda, and I was very lucky to actually dive in a modern submersible, one where the sphere is actually made of perspex, at the very spot where he did his first dive. So that was really a marvellous experience.
The first bathonauts plunged into the depths in what was essentially that hollow steel ball, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that is incredibly small. There's a very nice museum in Bermuda where they have a replica of these original bathyspheres. And I mean, certainly I go into very small vehicles, but these are really literally small steel balls with a single porthole to look out into the world beyond.
Even with your lifelong knowledge of the oceans, it must have been an extraordinary personal experience and a revelation for you to start going deeper and deeper and deeper.
Absolutely. I mean, I first got my fascination for marine biology going out on fishing boats with my grandfather on the west coast of Ireland. And that fascination with looking over the side of the boat and into the dark blue beyond the boat really never left me. To have the privilege of actually having gone to great depths in the ocean and explored parts of the ocean never seen before with human eyes using robots or submarines has really been exciting.
On your 2016 dive off Bermuda, you ventured to an intriguing place called the Twilight Zone. Tell me what you found.
Yeah, that was a really quite a remarkable turn up for us because we were expecting Bermuda to be quite well explored. There's been a marine lab out there for over 100 years. There's a lot of modern oceanography done around Bermuda. But when we visited this zone between 30 metres depth and 300 metres depth using these very modern submersibles, we discovered that, in fact, this zone had almost fallen between the cracks in the pavement in terms of science. It's a zone which is too deep for scuba divers to reach, but too shallow for really deep submergence equipment. So, for example, in terms of seaweeds, we found more than 40 new species of seaweeds occupying this twilight zone, this area where there's sunlight, but it's quite dim light, and many other
species. I understand that
well.
You're talking about a depth where only 1% of incident sunlight penetrates.
Yeah, down the twilight zone in terms of the what we call the pelagic zone or the water between the surface and the seabed goes down to about 1,000 metres. And there, there's about 1% of sunlight in very clear waters.
You know, I want to go back to why the huge disparity in investment. And I'm going to argue a psychological case that there's something inspirational and aspirational in looking up to the heavens and in having that sense of the numinous and wonderment. You know, it's not quite the same looking down.
Yeah, I think there is something in that. People really quite easily capture this excitement of going off into deep space, finding, you know, planets around distant stars, perhaps going to visit Mars one day in person. But I think for the ocean, it was very much like that back in the days of Magellan and Columbus. There was real excitement then about exploring the ocean. And there's something about, you know, the mystery of space, the danger, the fantastic technology you have to use. But actually, all those things are present in terms of modern oceanographic research.
Well, one of the things is we keep wondering, is there life out there? And there's certainly a hell of a lot of life down there. There are so many species that you have helped discover. And there are plenty more waiting to be discovered.
Yeah, this is, people often say to me, oh, have you discovered a new species? Well, I can say that on most of our expeditions where we visit places which have been poorly studied, we find dozens of new species, if not hundreds sometimes on single expeditions. It's a simple fact that the most poorest or the most poorly investigated part of the ocean, which is the water column, we've only visited 0.0001% of that ecosystem.
I knew a bit about your work in the past, as it happens, and because I was very interested in the hydrothermal vents, which demonstrate the tenacity of life, the way living creatures can survive in what would seem to be absolutely impossible circumstances. Tell us about hydrothermal vents.
Yeah, these are deep sea hot springs where seawater penetrates the oceans. The crust of the seabed. They come into contact with really hot rocks and the water gets superheated, takes up various chemicals, becomes buoyant and rushes out the seabed. The hottest temperatures we've measured down in the Southern Ocean, that fluid can be up to 386 degrees C down there. And because That fluid contains chemicals. Life has basically adapted to use that chemical energy as a basis for a whole food chain, and we find life around vents in huge abundance.
It's interesting that you found them in the Antarctica, but scientists first discovered vents in the, in the middle to late 70s, while exploring an oceanic ridge near the Galapagos. Haven't the Galapagos been marvellous over the years for scientific inquiry?
Absolutely, yeah. And it was in 1977 that the first paper on that discovery was published. And it's really interesting that that actually triggered the whole science of astrobiology, because scientists realised that you could get life in the absence of sunlight that was actually able to gather energy instead of through photosynthesis, through a process called chemosynthesis by oxidizing chemicals. And that then started people thinking about the possibilities for life in other solar systems, and even the possibility that there may have been a second genesis of life in our own solar system.
It's seawater in hydrothermal vents, dear listeners, can reach temperatures of over 700 degrees Fahrenheit. Tell us about these little crabby things that hang around those vents.
Yeah, we had a real surprise in Antarctica when we first set eyes on the hydrothermal vents we discovered down there. They were surrounded by heaps of a crab called a Yeti crab. And they're called Yeti crabs because they're very hairy. In the case of the new species we found in the Southern Ocean, they have very hairy chests.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but they were also nicknamed Hoff crabs after David Hasselhoff because of the hairy chests.
Yeah, that's right. And David Hasselhoff actually tweeted about these crabs. He was very proud of the fact that they'd been nicknamed after him.
Describe them for me.
They're about the size of a fist, the biggest ones. They're completely white. They have no eyes. They have a smooth shell. And their belly, if you like, is completely covered in these fine white hairs, which they actually grow bacteria on.
And then they cluster together in quite large communities, almost like coral polyps.
Yeah, absolutely vast numbers and layer upon layer of the crabs. And what they're all trying to do is muscle in on their most favourable spot to get access to the vent fluids, which have hydrogen sulfide to feed their bacteria.
Alex, if they get too close, of course, they'll cook. And if they're too far away, they won't get the nourishment.
That's absolutely right. And we saw them actually fighting for the best spots. And also we found specimens of the crabs which actually had burns on them. Some of them even had cooked limbs where they'd just got too close to the hot water.
It's not surprising that they're eyeless, given that there's no light. I'm intrigued by the fact that their whiteness. We think when we think of creatures in the ocean, they're usually so vividly coloured. But I guess the deeper you get, the less relevant colour becomes.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. At those depths, there is an absence of light. So there's not much point in actually manufacturing pigment to be some sort of colour. Colour is only really useful if you can see it, where it can be used for camouflage or display.
Talking to Alex Rogers, Science Director of the Norwegian Foundation, REV Ocean, his new book, The Deep, The Hidden Wonders of Our Ocean and How We Can Protect Them. Now let's look at the second part of that subtitle. Why do we need to protect them? You say that even vent animals, despite living in the very deepest part of the ocean, are highly vulnerable to climate change.
Yeah, this may be surprising to people, but it's a simple fact that these animals need access to lots of oxygen. And one of the effects of climate change is reducing the amount of oxygen in the ocean.
What about bottom trawling? Is that another risk? Deep sea trawling?
It certainly is, and it's still a risk. This is something I've been dealing with for several decades now. Bottom trawling obviously involves dragging heavy gear across the seabed where there are communities of very fragile animals. And certainly in places like seamounts, where you have deep water coral habitats and sponge habitats, those trawls can be enormously destructive.
I should have mentioned in the past that one of the things you've discovered on your deep dives, a colourless coral, black coral. Once again, no need for colour.
Yeah, black corals are called black corals because their skeleton is black, but the actual flesh of the animal varies between white. Some of them actually are coloured. They can be a deep red or orange. But that's often where these animals are up in this twilight zone area.
I remember years ago being concerned by predictions of deep sea mining and the threat it might pose, because extraction methods could involve the operation of huge remote vehicles on the sea floor that would, crush and break up the seabed rock.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we're in a phase at the moment where a UN body, the International Seabed Authority, is granting licenses to explore seabed beyond coastal waters for minerals. And they've given licenses out covering an area which is equivalent to the 20 largest countries in Europe for exploration for polymetallic nodules on the seafloor.
So the International Seabed Authority is drawing up a draft mining code.
Yes, that's right. And we've been looking at that very closely and raised many questions about that. I think my biggest concern about that code has been that essentially it looks towards the industry to kind of self-monitor and self-regulate.
Well, we all know what self-regulation leads to, absolute yes. Chaos. And of course, exploration is gathering momentum, isn't it? I understand there's undersea mining license granted off PNG coastlines and successful mining off Japan.
Yes, that's right. We saw the first trial industrial-scale mining off Japan in 2017. And they said they pulled up in that short trial enough zinc to last Japan for a year. But the problem is that some of the ecosystems they intend to mine include things like hydrothermal vents, where there is a high level of endemism. The animals are not found anywhere else, or they're biologically very rich.
We were well aware of the space race, but I wasn't aware that there was a depth race as well. I learned from you that China has the most advanced submersible, which can reach depths of 4,500 meters.
China have just built a very advanced submersible, but interestingly, a private funder has just built the world's first repeat dive submersible capable of reaching the deepest depths of the ocean. And they're currently engaged in an expedition to dive the five deepest places on Earth.
Now, I know there's a lot of space junk floating out there. In fact, we did a program on it just a few weeks ago with an academic from the deep south of America is all that comes to mind, who wants to have certain things on the moon made into World Heritage Sites. But of course, we should be looking at that as a solution, or at least a part of the solution, for the ocean depths.
Yes, absolutely. And there's certainly a good case that some deep sea sites should be made World Heritage Sites. There is a number of seamounts, for example, which have an incredibly rich life. There is a hydrothermal vent site called Lost City, which is on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, which is completely unique in terms of what we've found so far, and may have conditions very like those that led to the rise of life on Earth.
I should also point out to the listener that there's plastic in the deepest and most inaccessible regions of the ocean. not simply on the surface, but way down there.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a really horrible surprise in the Southern Indian Ocean back in 2011, 2012, when we were working there. And we found that all of our samples from the seamounts in that region were contaminated with microplastic fibres.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Now, of course, the UN, and we're out of time, but has just published a damning report warning that 1 million species are at the risk of extinction. And I suspect that that report doesn't take into account vast numbers of, any number of species in the oceans, because we don't know enough about them. Look, thank you. Thank you very much for your time, Alex. Alex Rogers, Science Director of the Norwegian Foundation REV Ocean, visiting professor at the Department of Zoology at Oxford. And his book, which I'm holding up to the microphone, is The Deep Hidden Wonders of Our Oceans and How We Can Protect Them. It's out now from Headline Publishing.